Hello and welcome to COVID Cast, a weekly Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effects of the coronavirus on the world and international life. My name is Richard McGregor and I'm a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we're sitting down every week with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implications of the coronavirus for the world. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Chris Buckley, a journalist with the New York Times in Beijing. We're lucky to have Chris here in Sydney, but that might not be how he sees it. He's originally from Sydney. He got a PhD in China Studies from the ANU, and for more than a quarter of a century has been in China as a student, researcher, and as a journalist. The only reason that Chris is with us here today is that the Chinese government has not renewed his journalist visa, and so he was forced to leave the country. For the first 4 months of this year, immediately before he left, Chris was in Wuhan. So let's get right to the conversation now. Chris, it was only a few months ago at the start of the crisis in Wuhan that people were talking about China's Chernobyl, as though the country was melting down because of the pressure of the coronavirus as it spread throughout China, then to the rest of the world. There were political problems, there were social problems and the like. 4 or 5 months later, China seems to be coming out of the COVID crisis. The US and European countries fell into it with a much sort of larger thud, if you like, much larger, greater number of deaths. And of course, the US, we have riots on top of that over race relations issues. So given that background, how would you describe Xi Jinping's political position in China today? And was he really in trouble, not of losing his job, but, you know, the party losing its legitimacy 4 or 5 months ago?
Well, we're only a few months into a crisis that I think is going to unfold for many months, if not years to come. So it would be a mug's game to try to predict how this is going to affect Xi Jinping and China in the end. But I think so far, what we can see is Xi Jinping and the Communist Party coming out of this crisis, this double health and economic crisis, in surprisingly robust shape, which is quite a turnaround from a few months ago. As you were saying, Richard, I think initially when the outbreak in Wuhan began to expand across China, when hospitals in Wuhan struggled with thousands of patients who were demanding treatment and not receiving it, when doctors and medical workers were falling ill for lack of protective equipment, that was a severe crisis for the government. And what we've seen since then is the Chinese party leadership claw back to, I think, a much more stable and confident place than it seemed a few months ago. Now, I think that probably comes down to, putting it very crudely, to do factors. First of all, whatever questions there may be about China's reported infection numbers for COVID-19, it does seem that they have drawn down the infection rates sooner and probably faster than many people expected, at a time when advanced countries, including, of course, the United States, have had a great deal of trouble coming to grips with this outbreak. And we've seen a great deal of mistakes and mismanagement in the United States and other countries as well. So I think those two factors, first of all, the fact that China, through this vast mobilization of resources, was able to come to grips with the domestic outbreak, and also the spectacle of mismanagement in advanced Western countries, has played to Xi Jinping's advantage. All that said, if we imagine an alternative scenario in which, for example, this outbreak had continued in China and Western countries, including the United States, had had far fewer infections, in that kind of scenario, could we imagine, for example, that Xi Jinping's very power would be imperiled? I think even in that scenario, a politically bleaker scenario for China, I would be surprised then if the conditions were there for a serious challenge to Xi Jinping's power. I think it would certainly be a blow to his prestige and authority, but I think his power is so entrenched at this point that I don't think even a severe crisis like that would have imperiled his grip on the party.
But of course, that didn't happen. China did pretty well in the end, leaving aside what happened at the very start. The US and European countries didn't, by contrast. So is Xi and the sort of propaganda system able to say with some credibility to its people now, our system worked, democratic systems didn't.
I think, put crudely, that's certainly a message that the Chinese propaganda machine is putting forth. And of course, when it does that, it can point to mistakes in the West, and certainly in the United States at the moment, as we see these protests rolling across the country, many Chinese people are looking at the United States in particular, seeing it as a diminished and troubled power. At the same time, I think within China, we have to divide opinion and sentiment about Xi Jinping and the party into different segments. I think it's probably true at the broadest popular level that that message that the party and Xi have come through this stronger, in a sense, vindicated while Western countries have struggled, that does have some resonance with the broader public, I think. At the same time, I think it's probably true that there are segments of the political, economic, and academic elites that probably take a colder and much more skeptical eye at the propaganda coming out of China now. And one of the great mysteries, one of the great questions is how has the inner elite of the Communist Party responded to the drama of the past few months? You know, these are the few hundred or few thousand people who have much more privileged access to information and a much clearer understanding about internal party decision-making from the outbreak of COVID-19 up to the present. They're the kind of people who would have a much clearer understanding of the missteps that the party leadership made earlier on. So I think one of the big questions going forward is not just how public sentiment has responded to China's handling of this crisis, but how elite opinion within the party is responding as well. Now, when I say that, I'm not suggesting, for example, that there is already a coalescence of forces within the party that would have any chance of challenging Xi Jinping at this point. But nonetheless, I think as Xi Jinping begins to look to the next party congress, which, please remind me, Richard, I think it's 2022. I think, you know, when people start looking at the scoreboard of his tenure in power, how the elite views the past few months is going to count in a distinctive way from how the propaganda system presents it.
Well, that's a very interesting issue, and I guess we don't really have a clear view of that, but perhaps also because China's got a sort of backs to the wall mentality at the moment because of criticism from the outside world about China's handling of it initially, in other words, calls for an inquiry and the like. So the system is kind of clammed up, but within that, you have no doubt that there's a more self-critical view about China's handling of it rather than a sort of more triumphant view.
Well, I think even publicly we've seen some hints or symptoms of that. I think in particular what we have seen is that, you know, insofar as China's been able to come to grips with this epidemic, it's relied heavily on the expertise and the knowledge of the traditional bureaucracy, especially the medical bureaucracy, at a time when it had seen that that traditional, conventional government bureaucracy was being displaced by central top-down party power under Xi Jinping. And I think what we have seen is that there have been some officials and certainly medical experts who have voiced muted but unmistakable misgivings that this air of triumphalism that has emerged in the wake of China's coming out of this crisis, that might constrict the space that is necessary to have a candid discussion about what policy changes are necessary to improve the public health system, to improve the monitoring system for contagious diseases and pathogens. And I think there is some concern that if...
Plus the need for the communication system as well, because in theory China had a process in place post-SARS so that this would not happen again. And it appears that that system failed.
Precisely. And I think even publicly we've seen Chinese medical experts come forward and say, yes, we can be proud about how China's handled bringing down infection rates, but please look at the early mistakes and in particular the failure of that direct reporting system. And let's fix this system and not just get carried away by triumphalism.
And of course, the other issue, China is opening up again. Quarantines have been lifted. But we do forget that it was a brutal quarantine. really tough on people, particularly in Wuhan, the epicenter. You were there. Can you give us a sense of what it was like being in Wuhan when the city was locked down at the time?
Yeah, it was an extraordinary time to be in Wuhan. I feel very privileged to have seen how the city survived those few months. I should say that when I went to Wuhan, which was on the day that the lockdown took force on January 23, when I hopped on the train from Beijing, I had a backpack with me with some clothes and a few masks and some other protective equipment. And I told my family that I'd probably be gone for a week or two. I thought this is a very serious challenge for the Chinese government. In a week or two, they'll probably have this under control and we can get back to Beijing and it will be a black mark against Xi Jinping's reputation and will have spoiled many people's Lunar New Year holidays. But then life would resume. Well, I never expected that several months later this would have evolved into this global catastrophe that we've seen unfold. So at the time, arriving in Wuhan, when I got off the train, I expected at that point, right after the lockdown had been announced, I would have seen a city that was heavily under armed security. I expected to see soldiers on the streets. I expected to see a heavy police presence. I expected to see large numbers of people's armed police enforcing this lockdown. As I think we all understand now, it was an extraordinary decision to lock down an entire city at that point. And a lot of people had questions about whether it was going too far or whether it could work.
And many people, of course, outside hadn't heard of Wuhan, but it's a city of 10 million people, but also a very sophisticated city. It's not some backwater.
It's a big modern city on the Yangtze River and a population of 10 or 11 million people. Big industrial base, a big transport city as well. And as you say, a very sophisticated city. So I couldn't see how lockdown could have worked without heavy security. So I was very surprised when I stepped out onto the streets there to see that, yes, there were certainly police around. And occasionally you would see people's armed police and fleeting glimpses of the military as well. But the way the lockdown worked really relied, I wouldn't say it was on voluntary behavior by citizens, but it did involve a great deal of heavy persuasion, cajoling, pressure and restrictions, enforced in the end often by the local party apparatus as well. So one of the things that being in Wuhan really brought home to me was how in the past few years, especially under Xi Jinping, we've seen this effort to reinvigorate the Communist Party apparatus, including at the grassroots. And there's been problems about that, and that certainly hasn't always worked. But I think in this case, we did see that the party's response at the grassroots in enforcing this lockdown relied very heavily on local party committees, mobilizing party members to do the hard work of telling people to stay indoors, monitoring people's comings and goings, and also, in particular, monitoring households where infected people had been identified. So much more than a security presence, I found it was very much a party presence that carried the lockdown through. The other thing that I remember very much looking back at the Wuhan experience is, I think, the Chinese government now talks about Wuhan being a model of how societies and cities can respond to this outbreak in an effective way. That may well be true in some ways, but as you say, it required a great deal of very harsh decisions, or brutal decisions sometimes, that might be, I think, unthinkable in many liberal democracies.
The Chinese management of this is not really replicable outside of China.
Certainly large elements aren't directly replicable outside China. And unless you have a very large Communist Party apparatus in your neighborhood, a lot of it's not going to be directly replicable either. The other thing that people can sometimes forget, and I sometimes forget as well, is that even in Wuhan, the measures that ultimately succeeded in bringing down infection rates they didn't snap into place immediately. There was almost a process of trial and error of finding the right recipe of policies that was needed to bring down infection rates at a steeper curve than we were seeing. And in the first few weeks in Wuhan, you know, there was certainly a lockdown, and it was certainly difficult to get around, and most shops were closed. Nonetheless, it was still possible for most people to go out and do their shopping, to go out for strolls, and certainly to turn up at hospitals for medical checks as well. So you go to most general hospitals in Wuhan, and there would be, you know, many hundreds of people, mostly elderly people, milling outside waiting to get tests done for what they feared would be the coronavirus. So at that point, there was certainly a lockdown and restrictions, but not this comprehensive, all-enveloping lockdown that fell into place in the following weeks. And what we did see going into February is a much more stringent set of measures in which nearly all residents were restricted to their homes, in which people couldn't even go to supermarkets to buy food most of the time. They had to rely on those local party committees that I was talking about, essentially to do their shopping for them, or these courier services that were still up and operating. And at that point, the lockdown truly became a lockdown. I was in a position where it was possible for me to step outside my hotel occasionally for errands and to have a quick look around, but I would step out onto the streets and I would see some street sweepers. They never stopped sweeping the streets. Couriers going around. Local party committees who were organizing household checks and transports to take people to hospital. But apart from that, you would see very few civilians on the streets. And all of this is happening at a time when, as I said before, I'm sure there was a security presence in the background, but it really wasn't something that was in your face when you stepped out on the streets.
Okay, so if we can widen the lens again, one of the big issues facing China, as with every other country in the world, maybe particularly with China, though, is post-COVID-19, there's going to be an extended economic slowdown. We don't know how long and at what level, but certainly China hasn't really experienced this, people would say, since the late 70s. In other words, we've had negative growth for a few quarters this year, maybe annual growth at about 2% maximum. How much of that is an issue for Xi Jinping and the Politburo to manage? How worried are they about this slowdown?
Well, I think they must be very concerned because we've been talking so far about how China's come through, you know, surprisingly come through this crisis so far, with the party leadership in a fairly robust position. Nonetheless, in the end, so much in China revolves around economic growth, job creation, and also revenue creation. And to the extent that an extended slowdown in the economy is going to hit employment, especially of migrant workers, to the extent that it's going to be a drag on government revenues, and to the extent that COVID is also going to have to demand a rethink of government spending priorities, I think that creates all sorts of complications for the party leadership going forward.
And there's certainly no consensus on that either, what kind of stimulus, if you have a stimulus, how you direct it, et cetera, et cetera.
In particular, a time when the party leadership, I think, has shown that it's worried about piling on more debt, especially on local governments. And so there does seem to be, you know, a debate or some uncertainty within the leadership about how far to go in stimulating the economy through traditional measures. At a time when one of the key problems for economic growth is not so much how much money you can put into the economy, but how you can instill confidence in spending at a time when there's still a great deal of worry in China about the prospects for the economy, about families' employment prospects, about job prospects for graduating students. When all of those uncertainties cloud over the economy, you know, traditional stimulus might not be enough. So how does this government, which is very adept at mobilizing and when it wants to shoveling money into the economy, how does it instill that confidence back into consumers?
Just finally, Chris, quickly on foreign policy. We've seen a big debate in China, outside China, about so-called wolf warrior diplomacy. Very harsh words used by Chinese diplomats at home and abroad against critics of China. How do you assess that phenomenon, and do you think there's a consensus within China that this works in China's national interest?
Well, I think what we have seen, and it did predate Xi Jinping, let's remember that, is that Chinese foreign policy has become more outspoken, more assertive, and in some ways more aggressive as well. And I think one of the underlying developments that explains this shift in China's public positions on many foreign policy issues, what we have seen, I think, is that under Xi Jinping, the entire government and party apparatus has sort of been shifted to putting greater emphasis on shoring up the prestige and standing of the Communist Party and the Communist Party leadership. And that includes the Chinese Foreign Ministry, and it includes Chinese diplomats.
So they're getting with the program, as it were.
They're getting with the program. And I think what we have seen is that to the extent that you are mobilizing diplomats, spokespeople for the Chinese Foreign Ministry, websites of Chinese embassies abroad, to extend the propaganda and ideological mission of the Communist Party leadership, that can rub up against the traditional methods and imperatives of China, of diplomacy, even in China. And so what I think we have seen is it's a little bit more complicated than simply saying Chinese foreign policy has become more assertive or aggressive. It's also become more dominated, I think, by these propaganda and ideological imperatives that are ultimately being driven by domestic political imperatives rather than by conventional foreign policy demands.
It's internal Chinese politics spilling out into the global realm.
Spilling out. And I think we have seen, for example, when China's very experienced ambassador in Washington, Sui Teng Kai, publicly slapped down one of the Chinese foreign ministry spokespeople who was spreading conspiracy theories about the origin of the virus. I think we did see then is some sort of playing out publicly of this tension between conventional diplomacy and statecraft and the imperatives of propaganda under Xi Jinping.
Chris, we could go on all day, but thanks for joining me for today's discussion.
Good to be here, Richard.
COVIDcast is a limited edition weekly podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thanks to my colleagues, Jennifer Reinhardt and Aaron Bassett, for production assistance. Please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast. And you can stay up to date with all the latest developments on coronavirus via the Lowy Institute's widely read digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and we'll catch up again with you next week.